Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center presents Doc Talk, an informative health series educating our community on the services provided at Peace Health. We will begin with our host, George Henry, after these messages.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better total care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
With flu season just around the corner, now is the prime time to schedule your annual flu shot. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control recommend that everyone aged 6 months and older, and especially older adults, get vaccinated against the flu. Peace Health Medical Group in Florence has adult and pediatric flu shots available. Call 541-997-7134 to make an appointment for your flu shot today. It only takes a minute and helps protect you, your family, and the community this flu season. So call 541-997-7134 today. On this edition of Doc Talk, sponsored by Peace Health, Peace Harbor Medical Center, we're talking with Dr. Bill Prosser. He's a doctor of nurse anesthesia practice at Peace Harbor Medical Center. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Let's get into what you do in a minute, but let's first talk about you and tell me a little bit about your background. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in rural Maine, place real similar to Florence, except it snows a lot more and it's a little colder. And I first started out as an emergency room nurse in the Army Nurse Corps, and had a background in psychobiology before that. And so I kind of gravitated towards the field of anesthesia because it involves all of those things.
Well, what made you want to do it in the military? Was it a matter of choice? Was it kind of what you felt comfortable with? Was it an open slot? Because, I mean, some people don't know. They say, oh, well, I'll just take that job, you know.
Well, I had met some medics and met some licensed vocational nurses in the Army, and it seemed what they were doing seemed really appealing. And with a quick investigation at my local ROTC, they were, of course, happy to have me, which made my veteran father chuckle. And it seemed like a great way to get school paid for, to get a good education, and to have a really structured and progressive educational opportunity after I graduated from nursing school.
So you went to nursing school and then you joined?
I joined while I was in nursing school and was a medic with the old Huey helicopters while I was in nursing school, and then took an active duty commission and wound up in Fort Ord, California.
So I guess what I want to know, though, is why the medical field? Was it just something you felt compelled to do while helping people, healing people?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have a lot of conversations with people that say, well, you know, what made you choose that? And most of the people I know that are in this feel like it kind of chose us. And that, you know, it seemed appealing, it seemed to fit, it seemed like something that I had a natural talent for, and so I wound up doing it, and then wound up continuing to pursue it.
So you took a commission then when you went in?
Yes.
So you're second lieutenant?
Correct.
And then how long did you stay in?
Well, I was an ER nurse at Fort Ord, and I stayed in for a little over 3 years there. And then I left because there were other things that I wanted to pursue, and particularly wanted to work at a large trauma center. And so then I wound up doing that at UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento, kind of during the height of the gang wars, which was a great experience for me as a young leaving the Army nurse. I actually stayed in the reserves for another 12 years after that in the Army Reserves, and then switched to the Navy Reserves for 6 more years.
Wow.
Primarily because I had taught some courses down at Balboa Naval Medical Center, and there was more going on in the Navy Reserve at the time than the Army Reserve, so I switched.
That gave you an opportunity to add a few more years. Did you then do a partial retirement?
I didn't stay quite long enough to retire. I did spend a year down there supporting the first war in Iraq and at Camp Pendleton, mostly taking care of Marines that were coming back, and then went back to UC Davis Medical Center and wound up retiring from there.
So now you eventually went to medical school then to get your doctorate, or is it a different kind of doctorate?
Well, nurse anesthesia is a slightly different. It's a different progression than traditional medicine, where, you know, to be a nurse anesthetist, you have to have a bachelor's degree in nursing, and then you need a year or two of good, solid critical care experience. And then you go back, and at the time, this was in the mid-90s, everybody was prepared to a master's level. And so I went and graduated in 1996, and continued to work at a master's level as a nurse anesthetist, and had always wanted to continue to a doctoral level of education. Once I actually retired and we got the kids out of the house and we had moved up here to Florence, we had the time, or I was encouraged by my wife to go ahead and finish that out. And so then I went back to school at Virginia Commonwealth and just finished there in August.
Well, then congratulations. This is new for you then.
Yeah.
All right. So you're married.
Yes.
Have a couple kids. How many kids?
Well, we're a little bit of a blended family. So we have five between us.
I'm familiar with that, yeah.
And three of them live here in Florence, and then one is in college down in California, and then my youngest is in the Army at Fort Gordon, Georgia.
All right, so let's see what time we got here. I tell you what, let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back and we'll talk to you about what the specific job you do at Peace Harbor.
Okay.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Prosser. He is the doctor of nurse anesthesia practice at Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. We'll be back in just a moment.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better Total Care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
With flu season just around the corner, now is the prime time to schedule your annual flu shot. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control recommend that everyone aged 6 months and older, and especially older adults, get vaccinated against the flu. Peace Health Medical Group in Florence has adult and pediatric flu shots available. Call 541-997-7134 to make an appointment for your flu shot today. It only takes a minute and helps protect you, your family, and the community this flu season. So call 541-997-7134 today.
On this month's edition of Doc Talk, we're talking with Dr. Bill Prosser. He's the doctor of nurse anesthesia practice at Peace Harbor Medical Center. And let's talk about that. What is the difference between that and an anesthesiologist?
Well, the science and practice of anesthesia are exactly the same. The procedures that we're trained to do, the medicines we use, the studies we follow, or the science we practice is exactly the same. We arrive in this place by two different educational paths, where typically becoming a nurse anesthetist is arguably the most clinically advanced a nurse can become in the United States. And
I guess that because you're a nurse first and then you add anesthesia on top of that.
Right.
Okay.
And, you know, it's much more technical than my traditional nursing background was. All of the procedures and things are the same. Typically now, it's been an evolution actually since the first nurse anesthesia program was in the United States, was started in Oregon in I think 1908 up at St. Vincent's. And there it was on the job training. It evolved then eventually to a master's degree. And by 2025, all nurse anesthetists in the U.S. will be doctorally prepared. So they'll have a bachelor's degree, they'll get their critical care experience, and then they'll spend 3 to 4 years in a nurse anesthesia program. That's kind of the direction it's going in. Our educational requirements have been growing steadily since the profession started in, realistically, the 1930s. So the difference really is in structure and timing of the educational process more than actual content between what somebody might learn going the medical path, where typically they'll go to medical school. They could have a degree in history, go to medical school and then come out and start their anesthesia training. And typically we go to nursing school, get a bachelor's degree, get some good experience, and then go back to graduate school to train as a nurse anesthetist.
Hmm. That's pretty cool. So let me ask you something. If you go back to, say, Hippocrates and you look at the medical field and then you look at anesthesiology, where does that line up as far as the history of it goes? How long have we been doing anesthesia in the modern day sense?
Well, really, the 1840s, late 1840s, was the beginning of modern anesthesia, where diethyl ether and nitrous oxide were discovered as compounds that could be used to anesthetize people. Also chloroform. Chloroform was popular in Europe. Nitrous oxide actually became popularized by the Cleveland Clinic, and diethyl ether became popularized by the Mayo Clinic. And even today, you can see what someone's educational lineage is, often by the way they practice, and whether in the U.S., they were trained by disciples of the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic.
So the last one is, most people know it just typically as ether, right? I mean, that's
right.
the straight term.
Regular ether, yep.
What do we know about anesthesiology and the brain and how it affects the brain? Is there any long-term with people that, say, have to go under multiple times?
You know, I think there's some real research starting to go on in those areas. What we do know is that as the anesthetic agents have become more modernized and the reliance on things like narcotic medications and benzodiazepines, or which is another way of saying Valium-like drugs, have kind of gotten pushed to the back, the impact on the brain has become less. We, and most of the partners in my group, tend to do a lot of anesthetic with a drug called propofol, which most of the research shows has less longer-term cognitive impact than what you would think the typical anesthetic gas or ether-related compound might do.
And is that's a non-opioid, though, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And how does that differ with, say, the practice of using opioids along with that? Because I think I've noticed in the last few years especially, they've been pulling back from that, and they've even been encouraging doctors in that not to use the opioid for pain management and stuff like that. How does that differ with that?
Well, most of us, when we were trained, were taught what was called a balanced anesthetic technique, which was, you know, a combination of opioids and anesthetic gases and maybe a couple of other things to kind of keep the patient in a stable plane where their nervous system wasn't processing the pain of the surgery, and that the gas was primarily keeping them unconscious. And so most people that were trained up until pretty recently had been relying on that model and using a decent amount of narcotics or opioids and some anesthetic gas to keep the patient unconscious. And probably that hadn't changed a whole lot since maybe the 1940s. And as we've started to realize that even as early as during surgery, a large exposure to opioids can start you down that road towards addiction and desensitization to the action of opioids, then the more modern culture in anesthesia is starting to pull away from it, like you say.
Is there a change in the way anesthesia is done now? Let me see if I can phrase this right. The idea that we've always seen in movies and talking with doctors and that is that the patient goes under, patient's fully under. Is that always necessary anymore, or is there some differences, like depending on the surgery, how far under they go? Is there a difference in thought today?
Well, yeah, there. You know, in the last 15 years, there have been a whole bunch of new drugs developed. There have also been a whole bunch of new techniques developed. And we've been progressing, you know, even at Peace Harbor, there were a lot of peripheral nerve blocks being done, which means you're injecting numbing medicine around the nerves of, you know, the hand or the leg or you know, spinal anesthesia or those sorts of things that then allow you to dramatically reduce the amount of other drugs that you need to make someone sleep. In the last few years, there have been increased use of ultrasound for the block placement, which makes it more accurate, We've some drugs that have been introduced. One of the drugs that we use is a time-release local anesthetic that can last for up to 3 days. And so not only does that help to dramatically reduce the amount of drugs we need to keep someone unconscious, but also dramatically reduces the amount of pain medicine they may need for even 3 days after the surgery.
I guess the thought along the years when it started in 1840 that the idea was you don't want a patient waking up because if they freak out, they move, they jump, they do something, it could cause them more damage in the long run. And that's probably still an issue because I know if I were to wake up in the middle of a surgery, I'd probably freak out.
Well, usually people start, if that were the case, people start moving long before they wake up. You know, just like someone who's maybe had too much to drink and you go start trying to wake them up, they'll start moving around and doing all kinds of things way before they turn around and tell you to leave them alone.
It's a very interesting science, you know, for sure. I tell you what, let's take another quick break and we'll come back. We're talking with Dr. Bill Prosser. He is the doctor of nurse anesthesia practice at Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. We'll be back in just a moment.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better Total Care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
With flu season just around the corner, now is the prime time to schedule your annual flu shot. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control recommend that everyone aged 6 months and older, and especially older adults, get vaccinated against the flu. Peace Health Medical Group in Florence has adult and pediatric flu shots available. Call 541-997-7134 to make an appointment for your flu shot today. It only takes a minute and helps protect you, your family, and the community this flu season. So call 541-997-7134 today.
We're back with Dr. Bill Prosser, Doctor of Nurse Anesthesia Practice at Peace Harbor Medical Center here in Florence. And we were talking about certain amounts of anesthesia and the necessity for keeping people asleep and that. Let's talk about body types and brains and things like that. I mean, obviously, we have a scale for how much somebody weighs, you know,
sure,
how much anesthesia they need. But is there also other factors that are considered in that? I mean, maybe somebody has a stronger will or stronger chemistry or something. What goes into deciding how much that person needs?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're starting to talk about more in anesthesia is actually the genetic influence on people's susceptibility to anesthesia. And as the human genome has now become elaborated and there are more people working in a field called pharmacogenomics, where they can look at your DNA and predict what kind of anesthetic drugs will work well, how much you might need, what you might be resistant to. That's a little bit in the future still, but a lot of times, you know, talking to someone and doing a really thorough preoperative interview, you can get a feel for what direction they're really going to do well in. And, you know, if somebody's a heavy drinker, usually they need more because their liver is better at getting rid of the anesthetic drugs. Sometimes people who have been on narcotic medicines for a long time, you may want to do a narcotic-free or a narcotic-reduced technique with them, and it may not be possible because of the changes taking all the opioids have made in their nervous system. People who are heavier, that effect kind of goes away after a little while because most of the fat doesn't really have a lot of blood vessels in it. And so you may have to increase your dose a little bit, but not proportionally to size.
Right. But not even overweight. I mean, if someone's 6'5 or 6'6 versus someone that's 5'2,
sure,
there's going to be a major difference.
It's, you know, it's not as big as you might think. Because
not incremental.
No, because you have to get a certain amount of drug in the blood to get to the brain, but everybody's brain is about the same size. And so once you start to get that in there or their nervous system, the size of their nerves are all about the same. So the body frame that's on the outside of that may be bigger and it may require a little more medication,
but again,
it's not like, you know, if somebody's twice as big, they won't necessarily need twice as much. And that's really part of where the art of what we do comes in, you know, being able to you're in the room with the patient, watching all of their physiology very, very closely. There are all kinds of subtle signs and clinical signs that you can use to judge and adjust the anesthetic. There are some brain activity monitoring devices that we can use in the operating room to help clarify that and help make sure that people are in the right place with the drugs that we give them.
What about, because I'm pretty sure this can be genetically backed up, although I might just be blowing smoke right now. But I had a friend of mine who, if she just even touched a little bit of alcohol, she was just totally off the charts versus someone who could drink an ounce or 2 ounces and be fairly unaffected by it. And I'm pretty sure that was genetic in her, or an allergy or something that she responded to. Is there something similar to that with the anesthesia that goes on?
Oh, sure. You know, there are basically, without getting super technical, there are basically five different neurotransmitters that we work with the anesthetic drugs. And if one of those particularly is off, or, you know, they don't have a lot of receptors in that area, a really low concentration will affect them really profoundly. Now, the other neurotransmitters, if somebody has a defect in one of them, the other ones will kind of adjust their activity to carry the ball so that person will seem pretty normal during the daytime. But if you expose them to a drug that targets that particular receptor, you'll get the effect that you were talking about, where they're way out of proportion to what you would think.
All right, help me out here. The five neurotransmitters.
Okay. How about norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, GABA aminobutyric acid, and did I say norepinephrine already?
Yeah, that was the first one.
Oh, okay. And histamine is another one.
Okay. All right. So all those, they kind of work together
to produce consciousness.
Yeah.
Oh, or wow. Who we are.
So I guess some of us are kind of failing in some of those transmitters there. They can be out of balance too, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And can they be brought back into balance?
Well, that's really the premise of psychiatry.
Well, I know some naturopaths would say, "Oh yeah, we can do it." Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, you know, it's a matter of
I honestly think that as genomic science and pharmacogenomics go a little bit further, we'll get a better grip on that. That's still fairly imprecise, just like anesthesia is fairly imprecise. But,
right.
You know, as people study and they get a better feel for the people that they're dealing with and the drugs that they prescribe and the effects that they have. And you know, truthfully, people can modify some of their neuronal activity by activities like therapy or positive thinking, if you will, or exercise
meditation
or all those kinds of things cause changes in the structure of their nervous system. And we don't understand that real well yet, but we're moving in that direction.
I think of a saying from the Bible that says, as a man thinks, so he is. You kind of take that and go, you know, you can maybe talk yourself into a better state of being sometimes, not necessarily health, physical health, but mental health at least.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the things that make you feel better are things like dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin. And, you know, if you engage in activities that increase the activities of those receptors or produce that, you get changes in the structure of the other receptors and more of them grow. And so, you know, we can all, to some extent, rewire our brains by what we think and what we do.
Of course, we're getting away from anesthesia.
That's true. A little ways.
But that's okay. Let's talk about some of the things that are coming at the hospital. You have some changes, some new things, that's going on, some maybe new technology, anything that you can talk about?
Well, sure. We're over the last couple of years, we've started moving towards extremely reduced or in many, many cases, opioid-free anesthesia. The time-release local anesthetic that we spoke of has been a little bit of a cornerstone of that, and it's really required a lot of support from the surgeons, the hospital administration, pharmacy staff, And we've all kind of worked together to go down this path to hopefully within the next couple of years make the majority of our surgery opioid free. We have the local anesthetic. We have different anti-inflammatories, different medicines that modify the activity of some of those other neurotransmitters so that people don't necessarily have any euphoria or high, but it helps to control their pain. And allowing four or five of those medicines to work together in small quantities minimize the side effects that we have and still control pain better than the opioid medications do.
Is there a chemical reaction or something that happens in the body when you use opioids during anesthesiology or anesthetics that continue to make the problem worse afterwards, and that's why it's not a good thing? Or is it an addiction thing to their euphoric feeling of not wanting the pain?
Well, there are a fair number of articles now that suggest that even the initial exposure to narcotics under anesthesia start the process. And, you know, many people watching the news lately have heard about the fentanyl coming in from Mexico. And you know, fentanyl is about 1,000 times as powerful as morphine. And there's another anesthetic opioid that's 10 times more powerful than that. So 10,000 times as powerful as morphine. And when you put that on receptors that normally respond to your endorphins, which are, you know, your body's normal pain control medicines, all kinds of things happen. And it's much like putting Miracle-Gro on your plants, only, you know, if you think of your nerves as being these little plants and you're putting something on them that you could never find in nature and causes all kinds of changes. So yes, the process can start in the operating room, and I think that's something we're all just becoming more aware of in maybe the last 2 to 3 to 5 years. And so there's a large push nationally now to find ways to reduce the amount of opioids that we expose our patients to in the operating room.
And like you said, you know, maybe in the next few years, it'll be totally opioid-free, possibly.
I think within the next couple of years, at least at Peace Harbor, we can go opioid free. We've gone in the last couple of years, we've reduced the amount of narcotics used in the entire facility by somewhere around 70% to 80%.
That's very good.
And I personally, it may have been 2 or 3 months since I've given anybody narcotics during surgery, and their pain scores are better than they were when we were using narcotics.
Well, very good. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we go? We're about out of time here.
Well, I do want to give a shout out to the administration at the hospital, to our orthopedic surgeons, our general surgeons who have worked on this project with us. We've put in a lot of time, and we've really had to sell the idea to the Peace Health system, which now they've grabbed a hold of and become a lot more supportive.
So they're on board there.
And so it's great. And you know, the timing with the national opioid emergency as declared by the president couldn't be better for what we've been working on.
And you guys were ahead of the curve on that.
We were, yeah. By a couple of years. We've got a great team of people, and we're all kind of thinking the same way about all this. So we hope to bring this to the community and use it to make people's experience better here in Florence.
Dr. Bill Prosser, he is the Doctor of Nurse Anesthesia Practice at Peace Harbor Medical Center. Dr. Bill, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, George.
This has been Doc Talk, presented by Peace Health, Peace Harbor Medical Center. For more information on the program and services provided, visit peacehealth.org.